All right, we shall proceed to finish up the 22nd chapter of the book of Acts and jump right into the 23rd just as soon as we can. All right, we went through a few illustrations last week, or as Eve refers to it, as the travel log. And I wanted to just reiterate some of those because I found some additional information. And Carolyn wasn't here last week, and she asked one of the questions. So, in the picture that I had of the temple from the first century A.D., we had this, which was, I think at this time, was at the Holy Land Hotel. It's now been moved to the Israeli Museum. And so the question was, what are these? And we talked about that last week. And then also the question was, how many people can you fit in there? So I think we discussed that last week as to how many people might be able to fit in there, and that supposedly this is a kind of a scale model and hopefully scale people. And we have one of the Anakim back here, but one of the giants. And then same thing here, a different one. And then we looked at this south side of the temple because we were wondering about these things right here, which are gateways, stairways. And so they come from what's now referred to as Huldah's Gate, or gates rather, a double arched gate here and a triple arched gate here with stairs leading up to them. And you can go into there and have direct access to the court of the Gentiles. Carolyn.
Say the name again of the gate.
Huldah, H-U-L-D-A-H. Okay. Huldah. She was a prophetess in Josiah's time, and they're the ones that she's the one that they went to get a prophecy about what's going to happen. And she told Josiah, who was a good king, whose father and grandfather were some of the more evil kings. Who was his grandfather? The son of Hezekiah. Manasseh. Yeah. And he's the one that actually ended up sort of the straw that broke the camel's back that caused God to finally condemn the southern kingdom. So this is just traditionally where she may have held court or something like that. So that's what those gates are. And so they go into the temple, and there's passageways in here, and they go up and come out at these stairways right here into the court of the Gentiles on both sides here. So that was interesting to note about that, that is there. Now, I had wondered as to what this was. Thought maybe it was like in the old temple, in Solomon's temple, that maybe it was the place where the priests and stuff. This is called the Royal Portico, and it's something that Herod built. Interestingly enough, Herod, of course, was not a Jew. So he spent a gazillion dollars building this temple mount, and he couldn't go in there. I mean, well, he couldn't go into the temple anyway. He could go into the court of the Gentiles, but he couldn't go in here into the temple area, into this area here, even though he spent so much money building it. So when he started in, what did I say, it was like 18 BC or something like that, to build this, it took him about 10 years to do that. So supposedly this was built before Jesus was even born. But then construction continued on the temple area itself until about 67 AD. So, like I say, they got to enjoy it for 3 years before it was destroyed. Somebody online that I saw today indicated that this door was 60 to 100 feet tall. Quite large. This wall, not that wall, this wall here is well over 100 feet tall. Now, the reason that we have tall walls here on the south side and also on the east side is that we're going down into valleys on both sides, the Kidron Valley on the east side, and I forget what the name of this valley is down here, but Herod had to spend a lot of bucks to fill all this in so that he could make the temple court even. Randy, you look like you're about to put your hand up.
Yeah, she just mentioned to me about Solomon's portico. Have we seen that?
Let me see if I have another. Oops. Uh-oh. Well, Maybe that's on the next presentation. So let's go back here. Supposedly, this is Solomon's portico. So whether it goes all the way across or not, I don't know. And then the one, this one here, we'll get into. I think I have more slides on the next presentation for 23 when we talk about the Sanhedrin. But this royal portico right here is supposedly where they did all the buying and selling. It was like the local market. And that's where Jesus would have done all his casting out and such. Because they are in the Temple Mount area. They're not supposed to be there doing that. And so when Jesus came and did that, that's what they did. So this is not stories with you know, rooms or something in them. This actually goes up. Some of these pillars are like 100 feet tall. A lot of this is just recreation, and some of it is supposition based on archaeological discoveries. Eve, did you have your hand up?
I might be the only one.
Most likely.
I might be the only one, but I find this impressive.
It
because
is.
To me, my standards, you know, when you say a temple, and I look at the temples today, you know, that are built for different religions, or you say courtyard, and you think of our courtyards, and then you look at this and you go, what?
Wow.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
I never really had it in my mind that it was to that magnitude.
I think what Solomon would have built would have been, you know, the equivalent of this. It probably looked a whole lot different. He, as far as I can tell, he didn't build something quite like that. But he built that and additional structures and things like this. And then when Herod decided that the almost 500-year-old temple that was sitting up here on Mount Moriah, supposedly, was getting kind of shabby, he decided to build a new one. Yeah, Lynn. No? Okay.
If those two outside courtyards are called courtyards of the Gentiles, it seems like they made a lot more room for Gentiles than they did for Jews.
They certainly did. Well, and this one here, right here inside the temple, this is called the Court of the Women in here. And then the menfolk could go in that courtyard. But then only the priests could go in, because this is the Holy of Holies here. So only the high priest could go in there. So, maybe Herod did that because he couldn't go in there. And so that gave him the opportunity to build not only the royal portico here and Solomon's portico. And it's called Solomon's portico because they suppose that this is where some of the things that belonged to Solomon might have been built at the time. And then I think there's one reference to something like Solomon's stables or something like that. I don't know. But it's out here on this side. And then, of course, Herod built the Antonia Fortress, which was joined hard to the synagogue here. So it was quite impressive also. And so they could access directly into the Court of the Gentiles from there. And all the hordes of people. You could see here, as I mentioned last time, this small wall that was supposed to tell you that Gentiles weren't supposed to go past that. Same thing over here. One of the things that I read this morning indicated that these passageways here were one, if not the main entrance into the temple area by the general populace. That it was apparently much more accessible to come in here. Though one picture that I looked at showed actually a rather large opening over here that didn't appear to be a gate, but it's just an opening, so I don't know. But the city was more down from the temple because the temple was up on a mount. And so the people would have been able to come this way, apparently, and access the temple area much more easily that way. So this was apparently a major entrance into the temple.
So those are stairs. People, they came in. This whole thing is up.
Yep. So they come in. They come in from down here. So there's the other side of that royal portico, and here's the entrances here at Huldah's Gate.
But when they go upstairs, like you said, it's built on a mount. So when they go up, they're still standing on dirt. They're not standing on a raised platform.
They are on a raised platform.
They are.
Yeah. My understanding is that all of this is
concrete and rebar.
Yeah, concrete and rebar. That's right. It's stress for aircraft and all that sort of stuff. So, So why, when Paul was talking to the crowd and he got to the evil word Gentile, he started throwing dust in the air? I'm unclear on that. Unless, for some reason, they carried dirt around in a bag with them, which I would not be surprised.
Maybe it wasn't completely paved.
Maybe not.
They were just dust.
It's a dusty place.
Maybe they needed dirt so that they could toss it into the air. So they left the place open for them. I don't know. That's my understanding. Is this wasn't this wasn't dirt, but
so what's underneath it?
What's underneath it?
Yeah, sort of basement.
Oh, well, this part right here is all on the level, but this part all had to be raised up with just fill. He just filled it up with dirt or whatever they fill things with. Maybe he filled it up with concrete and rebar. There were certain amounts, there were certain things associated with this that were accessible through the gates here, just little passageways and then the stairways up. And they supposed, because of the apparently number of sort of passageways that they found, that there may have been storage areas there too. Mm-hmm. So, but it doesn't like go under the entire temple area. This was another gate that apparently was a very often used gate to get into the Temple Mount, and I assume that its passageway connected with the passageways from Huldah's gate, so that everybody came up in those areas here. Because this doesn't appear to be on the same level as the floor there. But when we get to this area over here, the level of the ground over here is the same as the level here, but the level of this ground is significantly higher than the level of the ground down here. This, I believe, was the Golden Gate, or at least a representation of it. All right, so that hopefully will clear up a certain amount of stuff. All of this, once again, is just archaeological reconstruction, and a lot of it is supposition, but I think just traditionally they're called Huldah's Gates. There's obviously nothing in the Bible that says anything about Huldah's Gates in the temple. All right, let's go and finish up the last two questions that we have here on Acts 22. And so, why did the chief captain have need to become fearful? Lynn?
Because he had arrested Paul, and really was going to take the scourge, and without any kind of really evidence or a trial, and Paul announced he was a Roman citizen. And that was against the law to do that.
Yeah, yeah. So, doing something like the chief captain had intended to do to a Roman citizen could be punishable by death. I'm sure, since he was a Roman citizen but a Jew, they'd be more than happy to ignore that. But still, that may be Randy Bowles.
And certainly, treating him the way he did by binding him or laying him out to be scourged was certainly would warrant a reprimand.
Yes. Yeah.
Harmful to one's career.
Would be harmful to one's career. And since he was the chief captain, had maybe 10 centurions under him, that was quite the career to go in the dumpster. Yeah. All right. And then, before what group was Paul next taken to be examined? Of course, this examination was going to be a little less severe than the previous examination that was intended. But who was the next? What was the next examination? Say what? Chief priest, the Sanhedrin, right? So he was taken before the Sanhedrin council. What did the chief captain tell the Sanhedrin to do? He said, assemble. He commanded, it says, the Sanhedrin to assemble. Throughout the garments, had the chief captain, find it here. What? 30? Yeah. Commanded the chief priest and all the council to come together and brought Paul down and set him before them. So, Yeah, interesting that the chief captain could command the Sanhedrin to assemble. So, and I think we had some comment about that last week. The same group, though, what did they formally send him out to do?
Excuse.
Say what?
Persecution.
Yeah, exactly. I had something similar. The same group, essentially, the chief priest, had sent him out to, or he received letters from the chief priests and elders to go persecute Christians, to go to Damascus. And that's where he saw the light, as it were, on the way. All right. Let me switch presentations here. So now we have, in chapter 23, Paul is now being taken before the Sanhedrin Council. And so I've got some discussion of the Sanhedrin Council and its location and such like as we have here. Let's read part, anyway, of chapter 23. Somebody read 1 through 10, please. Randy, go ahead.
Acts 23, 1 through 10. Paul, looking intently at the council, said, "Brethren, I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day. The high priest Ananias commanded those standing beside him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, 'God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. You sit to try me according to the law, and in violation of the law, order me to be struck.' But the bystanders said, 'Do you revile God's high priest?' And Paul said, 'I was not aware, brethren, that he was high priest. For it is written, you shall not speak evil of the ruler of your people.' But perceiving that one group were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, Paul began crying out in the council, 'Brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of a Pharisee. I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead.' As he said this, there occurred a dissension between the Pharisees and Sadducees. The assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor an angel, nor a spirit. But the Pharisees acknowledged them all. And there occurred a great uproar, and some of the scribes of the Pharisaic party stood up and began to argue heatedly, saying, 'We find nothing wrong with this man. Suppose a spirit or an angel has spoken to him.' And as a great dissension was developing, the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them, and ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him back into the barracks."
All right, so chapter 23, 1 through 10, we can see that in this instance, Paul certainly knows how to play his audience, as it were. Right? So he says, and it says in what, verse 6, that he perceived that some were Pharisees and some were Sadducees, and he just set them off. And so that's whereas when he was speaking with the crowd above the court of the Gentiles, when he said Gentile, he didn't mean for them to start their riot all over again, as near as I can tell. I mean, he was still sort of in the middle of his speech. And here he saw an opportunity and he used it to further the condition that he was in. As we go through the slides here, Mickey has the slides listed as the second of five defenses after Paul's third tour. So let's list the five defenses. It took me a while to figure that out. So all of his slides, for the next several slides, are labeled the second of five defenses after Paul's third tour. So what's his first defense?
Before the people,
right? They're on the steps of the temple court. Okay. Now his second is the one that he already says it is. It's the one we're doing right now. It's Acts 23 before the Sanhedrin council. Now what's his third defense?
Felix.
How about a chapter? 24. I'll give you a hint. Turns out they're all sequential. So his third defense is before Felix, and then how about his fourth one? That's Festus. And then he's got a fifth one before Agrippa. Yeah. So, James got that, 22, 23, 24, 25, and 26. James got those all down. That's why we have this as the second defense after Paul's third tour. Now, as we look at this, we understand that Paul's brought before the Sanhedrin Council for questioning. Interesting to note that, as Mickey will comment on one of his slides later on, nobody really knew why they were questioning him. So,
why they were questioning him?
there had been all sorts of charges made against him that started the riot in the temple. And there was discussion, perhaps, in the barracks and in that area about what might have gone on. But the Sanhedrin Council was called together, and yet they weren't. There was no assertion made of the charges against him, as near as I can tell. Chris.
Well, by the time we get to the end of chapter 25, before Agrippa, they're like, he's already appealed to Rome, and they're like, we don't have anything to write.
Yeah, right.
We're looking to come up with something to write to send him to.
Festus says, I can't send it to the emperor without writing something against why I'm sending him there, right? So that makes sense, yeah. Carolyn.
Back in 21:38, when he speaks,
I
forgot what he's supposed to do, but he says, then you're not the Egyptian who stood up the
Lord. Oh, yeah.
Even that
guy. Right, the chief captain, Salati, was somebody else. Yeah, Randy.
Well, Claudius Lysias has determined that he can't have an accurate determination of the problem with a mob. He needs an organized assembly of leaders.
Right.
So he orders the Sanhedrin to assemble because these are the leaders. These are the people that should know why there's a ruckus.
Yeah.
You're the leaders of this mob. You tell me in a very easy fashion for me to understand what's the matter.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't know.
No, they don't.
They don't know what to tell them.
Yeah.
I mean, they're assembled. But then Paul takes the initiative. He doesn't wait to be accused. That's when he starts in verse 1. He takes the initiative and looks right and says, here.
Yeah.
I'll lay it out for you.
Isn't it, wasn't it in the temple that it said that some shouted something and some shouted another? They were in confusion there. Actually, you know, pardon? 34?
21:34,
yeah.
That's kind of the picture I get is the reason that Ananias commanded him to be smacked on the mouth.
Yeah.
Is because he took the initiative to start talking.
Right.
Instead of sitting there like a prisoner and waiting to be accused.
Yes. He did seem, it appears, to have a certain amount of freedom in that Claudius Lysias, not Sergius Paulus, Claudius Lysias released him from the chains, but he didn't release him from the prison, as it were. But I think that he probably gave him a certain amount of liberties, you know. But he certainly was a prisoner, and he was referred to as the prisoner at other times. I had a cheat sheet about the Sanhedrin. Anyway, the Supreme Jewish Court of Justice, not limited to religious affairs, but also had civil, but they could not do what? They could not authorize what? The death penalty. They seem to have authorized the death penalty under Jesus' circumstances.
They coerce Pilate.
Yeah, right.
For Stephen.
Oh, and for Stephen also, yeah. Right. Yeah, they just... Mickey originally had the council was composed of 70 members who sat in a half-circle pattern, but it actually is composed of 71 persons. It's the high priest and 70 others who sat in a half-circle pattern. High priest was the president, and so then we had chief priests, elders, and scribes, and actually they had some just regular people in there also. Okay. So now we've got some illustrations here. This is the one that Mickey had with us. This came from a Wikipedia, just says, from an encyclopedia from 1883. Didn't even say what encyclopedia, just an encyclopedia. So it's interesting to note when you look at some of these old pictures. For example, this one from 1883. I looked at some others from some other eras. And they essentially had them either wearing traditional, like, sort of Turkish robe type things, like from the Byzantine era, or in one of them I saw they were wearing the kind of suits that the people that were doing the artistry would have worn at their particular time, going, you know, like top hats and things like that, going, okay, Carolyn.
We just watched a special on Spain and the Moorish architecture, and that's what that was.
Moorish architecture, okay, yeah, that's right. It does look very...
Why are you stylized?
Right. It appears that when you look at historical shows and things like that, that the people back in the 1800s didn't have a real love of the truth. I guess they figured their facts couldn't be checked that well. So I have another picture here that I got from another website showing something a little less spacious than what they were showing here. But what particularly I wanted to show was that a lot of people will say that the Sanhedrin met in the temple in a place called the Chamber of Hewn Stone. Okay, so that was in an area in the regular priest courtyard, beyond the women's courtyard, and we discussed that earlier. And so in a little area here, it appears that that's where they would have taken him. So if they were at the Antonia Fortress, which was up on the northwest corner of the Temple Mount, in order to get him here, they wouldn't have to go very far. It's not like they have to go clear across town or anything like that. So it's just on the other side of the... So the court of the Gentiles is over here. They just have to come around over here or go through or however they get there. And then I have a picture here of the south side of the temple, which is not necessarily showing that area, but there are entrances over here in the courtyard area that... So this would have been the courtyard of the women here, Gentiles here and here, and then the courtyard of the priests or men or whatever it is there. So the Sanhedrin, according to tradition, would have met in this area somewhere. Yeah, Randy Bowles.
And surely there was an entrance into that chamber from the court of the Gentiles.
Oh, yeah, I would think so.
Otherwise, Sergius Paulus would not, or Claudius Lysias would not have been able to yank him out of the council.
True. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. So, if it was there's another thing. Of course, there's no absolute proof that's exactly where it was. So, another thought was that it was indeed in the royal portico. So, this was the area, like you say, where they, and notice that they drew the stairways using a different methodology here. This is the area where I said that they would have been doing the buying and selling and trading and all that sort of stuff. And so it is also supposed that at some time the Sanhedrin would have met here underneath the portico. It's easily accessible. And of course, Claudius Lysias, but not Sergius Paulus, could have gotten in there easily and without transgressing any of their rules and regulations and such like as that. So it could have been here in the royal portico. And so here's a fair depiction of what they have built there at the model in Jerusalem, the 1/50th scale of the city, of what the royal portico looked like. And so that's where all the trading and such would. And then Solomon's portico or whatever it's called was over here somewhere. And then here's a depiction of what it would have looked like inside. This a fairly large area and probably had some places where they could gather together and do such things. Once again, huge structures. Yeah, we're not looking at anything particularly small here. Those of you that have seen the Mormon Tabernacle up in Salt Lake City, I mean, it's a big building, but it's not anywhere of the size of this. This just makes that one look small. Bruce?
Yeah, that's all. I was just thinking about that because the Mormons have, what, 7 presidents?
Yeah. All right. Let me see. Oh, and so I was going to mention about the Sanhedrin. It turns out that the word Sanhedrin simply means something like sitting together or an assembly or a council, and that's all that it means. Apparently, much after the pattern that Moses laid out, there were smaller councils in all of the cities of any size throughout Israel. Apparently, there were Sanhedrin councils of 23 people in the cities roundabout. And the Sanhedrin that was here in Jerusalem was called the Great Sanhedrin, and it had the 71 people in it. And so, much like the way that Moses set it up, he said he was going to, they set up, I think he set up 70 people to judge throughout the people while they were on the road to the Promised Land. And those were to be the judges of the people, and then they were supposed to, if they couldn't make a decision in the matter, then they were supposed to bring that to Moses. And so this is supposedly set up much like that. So after, kind of after that pattern. And of course, we don't want even numbers in either the small Sanhedrin or the new Sanhedrin, because you don't want a hung vote there. And so, as a matter of fact, they went to great lengths to, in one of the articles, to mention why they had 23 judges as opposed to 21, things like that, because a simple majority wasn't good enough, that you had to have a majority that was greater than a simple majority. So if you had 23 people, then you could do it that way. Some of the Jewish logic is a bit strange. Oh, and it says that they also said, and I saw this in several articles, that the Great Sanhedrin convened every day except festival days and the Sabbath day. So they would have been in their meeting at some time anyway. I get the idea that when Claudius Lysias called them together, that perhaps they were, you know, it was earlier or later or something like that than when they normally would have. Any questions on the travel log so far? Yes?
When you mentioned the scale of the buildings, how does that compare to, say, the Greek ruins that we see today that were sort of kind of contemporary to that? Is it larger than those or smaller? It's never been.
We saw the Parthenon, though it had scaffolding all around. You couldn't really see the thing. But it was pretty huge. I mean, it might have been over 100 feet tall, do you think? Probably was. But it didn't appear to me, at least from what we could see just looking at the ruins, that it was particularly impressive. Of course, it was ruins that were, you know, a couple of thousand years old. So it probably was pretty impressive once it was when it was in its grandeur. But I still think that this is, for example, even great, even bigger than that.
Especially with
the courtyard. Yeah. Trying to think of what other big things there are. If you look at the, you know, the theater in Ephesus, for example, could hold 20,000-30,000 people, something like that. I think what Mickey said way back when we were studying in the second, anyway, one of the chapters. It was pretty big, but it was nothing the size of this either. And of course, it was just a theater. All right. So when we get into the Sanhedrin Council, where Paul is taken, we understand that he notes that there are two different kinds of people there. There are Sadducees and there are Pharisees. What was Paul? And he mentioned that, as a matter of fact, in his discussion, in his defense with the people in the courtyard. So the Sadducees, and Mickey has gotten most of this, I think, from the ISBE dictionary. The Sadducees appear to be aristocrats. In other words, they're of noble heritage, for example. But the Sadducees denied the resurrection of the dead. So if we look at Matthew, the 22nd chapter, and verse 23, anybody close to that yet? Matthew 22:23. All right, so Jim?
The same day, the Sadducees came to him, who say that there is no resurrection, and they asked him a question, saying, "Teacher, Moses said, if a man dies having no children, his brother must marry the widow and raise up children for his brother. Now there were seven brothers among us. The first married and died, having no children left his wife to his brother. So too the second and third down to the seventh. After them all, the woman died. In the resurrection, therefore, of the seventh, whose wife shall she be? For they all had her. But Jesus answered them, you are wrong, because you know neither the Scripture nor the power of God. For in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. And as for the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what was said to you by God? I am the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And when the crowd heard it, they were astonished at his teaching.
All right, so the Sadducees challenged Jesus on this point right here, and he told them that their understanding of the Scripture was incorrect, that or their understanding at all about resurrection as such was incorrect. He said, in the American Standard Version, he says, "You do err," in verse 29. Or Jim, what did I say? You're mistaken? In verse 29? Verse 29, "But Jesus answered and said to them, you are wrong, not knowing the Scriptures," in verse 29?
"You are mistaken."
"You are mistaken." Okay. "Not knowing the Scriptures, nor the power of God." So, they came to a conclusion, and this conclusion, Jesus says, was not based on the Scriptures. Because he said, you don't know the Scriptures, and you don't know the power of God. So I think he might probably mention that you don't know the power of God, because he's saying here that God can raise people if he so chooses, and that's what it'll do. All right, and then in Acts, the fourth chapter and verse 12, Acts, the fourth chapter and verse 12 says, say that again.
Acts
4, 2 might be more better. What's that say, Jenny?
If you start at verse 1, "And as they were speaking to the people, the priests and the captain of the temple and the Sadducees came upon them, greatly annoyed because they were teaching the people and proclaiming in Jesus the resurrection from the dead."
Oh, well, that works out a whole lot better. Okay. So let's go with 4:2 on this then. Acts 4:2, 1 and 2. Okay, now, as we had mentioned, Acts 4, 1 through 2, which is exactly what it says right there. And then Acts 23:8. Did we look at that yet?
"The Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit, but the Pharisees confess both."
Okay, the Pharisees confess both, so that spirit and angel and resurrection. And so we see that there's a great divide between the two types. Randy Gwoltz, did you have your hand up?
No, I was just going to say Randy just read that.
Oh. I must have missed that.
The beginning.
Oh, 1 through 10. Yes, of course. Yes, we're in chapter 23, aren't we? I lose track of where we are. And this is all from the ISB, which is International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. Consequently, they denied future rewards and punishments in a life to come. Sadducees denied the existence of angels and spirits. We just read this. And so the ISB says the consequent emphasis on life in this world was consistent with the Sadducees' concern with their position of power, status, and wealth. Left no room for messianic hopes and a coming kingdom of God. So, as far as the Sadducees were concerned, what you see is what you got, Randy Bowles.
And I think that between this and the fact that they were heavily influenced by Greek, I'm going to say theology, but Greek ideas.
Right.
They were what I think another way of looking at it is they were elitists.
Elitists.
They were the upper crust or the ones that were smarter than ever. These Pharisees are just, they're a bunch of right-wing radicals. Bible thumping.
Yeah. Most likely so. That's right. We might refer maybe in our vernacular, we might refer to the Sadducees as the liberals, right? They're not apparently taking the Scriptures to the proper extent that they should. Yeah, Carolyn.
If you're saying that they're the upper crust and they have everything now, then future rewards or punishment have no interest in them.
Yeah.
They're living it up right now.
And what were we listening to? Anyway, one of the sermons, I guess, just in the past, talks about people who have a lot of wealth. It's difficult for them to. Was it in the article today? People who have a lot of wealth have a tendency to depend on that wealth instead of looking to God for their reward. Was that right? That one. Okay. I knew I remembered it from somewhere fairly recently. So. All right, so ISBE, International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, a nice denominational encyclopedia if you want to look at it. Randy?
I don't remember if this is correct or not, so I'll ask you. But I have a vague recollection of remembering the high priest was a Sadducee.
I believe we came to the conclusion at some time that the Sadducees were sort of in charge at this time. There were more of them in the higher positions in the council than there were of Pharisees. In higher position, right. So it appears like, as far as the Jewish rulers went, the Sadducees were sort of in power at that time, at least more than the Pharisees. Randy?
And I think that what has happened during the couple hundred years prior to this, the high priest has lost being a descendant of Aaron.
True.
And it's now an appointed position by whoever the political.
Yeah.
I think it was just prior to this, there was one that had been, he paid a great deal of money to be able to be appointed to be high priest.
Right. I'm trying to remember where it was. One where there were two high priests, right? One was the son-in-law of the other one. Was that under Jesus?
Yeah, Caiaphas was Annas, son-in-law of Annas.
Oh, Annas and Caiaphas. Yeah. So there were like two of them. One was, I think, one was appointed by the Romans, and the other one was sort of a political appointee by the Jewish people. All right. Let's quickly, before the bell rings, go into this next one about the Pharisees. They had a strict regimen, as it says, of law pertaining to purity. You remember that Jesus in Matthew 23, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites!" So they took everything down to the nth degree, and then made a lot of rules and laws according to what they thought. And they perpetuated oral traditions handed down from the former teachers and the wise men of Israel. And so they were real big on what we would call rabbis said in the past. The oral law was what the Pharisees really venerated. They taught that this is what had been handed down from Moses. But we see no indication that any kind of oral law was handed down by Moses. Randy?
Just for next week, if you want something really interesting, research Pharisees.
Search?
There were various types of Pharisees.
Oh, okay.
One is, there's the black and blue Pharisee. And some of the rules they've come up with for their oral laws are really interesting. I'll put that in quotes.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, I read a book by James Michener called The Source once that talked about the lengths that traditional Jews went to be able to lengthen how far a Sabbath day's journey was and things like that. And it's just amazing the things that they went through. So next week, Mickey will be back to take over the class. We didn't make it to Revelation chapter 27. I thought maybe we would.